just to start things off, though, I wanted to start with the audience. I mean, the panel for just a minute, and maybe have the three of you. We'll start with you, Jonathan. Are there any inherent risks in using social media?
Well, there are if you'd like to stay employed. Yeah. People may not realize the fact that a little closer. Okay. People may not realize the fact that what you do on your social media links, the behavior you display, what you post, what you tweet, can get you in real trouble with your employer. And there are many examples in Charlotte of employees being disciplined or being terminated as a result of what their employer viewed as behavior that was incompatible with their continuing employment. You know, a couple of examples, I think the audience probably knows most of these. About 3 years ago, a group of Charlotte Mecklenburg teachers were terminated as a result of pictures posted on their Facebook pages that parents accessed, sent into the school board. You know, it was the typical drinking, partying stuff, and the parents said, this is incompatible with people who are teaching our children. They were terminated or disciplined as a result of that. Last year, Brick's waitress at Brick's restaurant uptown was terminated after she posted some negative comments regarding customers. And folks may also remember a couple of years ago that some KFC employees, I think in Kannapolis, videotaped themselves spitting into the food and then posted it on YouTube. And they got arrested for criminal misconduct as a result of that, in addition to being fired. So the answer to your question is, yeah, there are some real risks involved with your employers and in other aspects of the law involved with social media.
So, Danny, you have embraced those risks, have been willing to brave those in order to dive into social media. So what's that equation like for you? I mean, why are you willing to take those risks? And what have you done to try and, like, you know, keep your job?
Right. Well, you know, I think it's interesting because I've been reading a lot about this lately online. And some of the information that sort of struck a chord with me lately. I'm a part of Generation Y, which runs from like the mid-70s to early 2000s. They haven't really made a clear distinction on that exact time frame, but we are actually the last generation that will remember life before the internet. And so I think that it's been interesting to sort of see over the last 17 years, you know, the evolution of the internet and public consciousness, and then over the last just several years, what social media has done to that. When I was in college, you know, it was really when Facebook started to get some traction, was released to just university students. A lot of my friends were getting on there, and we were posting photos of, you know, what was happening during the weekends and things like that. Once I graduated and became a professional, really had to look, I think, at the networks that I was involved in and be a little more purposeful and intentional about the information that was going to show up there. Because you realize that, you know, those things follow you. There's been attention lately on, you know, your online reputation and your personal branding and what does that really mean. And I think for me, it's, you know, some networks are more open. I'm pretty open on Twitter. Anyone can follow me there, and, you know, I'll post about my professional life, but also some things about my personal life. Facebook a little bit more closed. So just trying to find and maintain a good balance between, you know, what the intention for each specific network and what who I'm engaging with there.
Right, so it's a decision each time you are posting in a different venue. It's a conscious decision that, you know, this is how far I go, this is my boundary in this particular venue. So, Jonathan, you're a faculty member, you have students, you also have, you know, a professional circle and then personal life. So how have you... Is it possible, do you think, to get the full benefit of all of these without experiencing any of the risks involved?
I don't think it's possible to get the benefit without experiencing the risk. One of the biggest issues that I see in terms of social media is that people are really good at recognizing the social part of it, but not really good at recognizing the media part of it. And media, by nature, is public. So what you do in social media is public. It's presented for everyone to see, regardless of whether there are privacy controls available to you. It's public. It's available to journalists. It's available to anyone who really would like to find it. So for me, I think about it in the same way that I think about sharing something with a newspaper reporter or doing something in an interview like this. I wouldn't get up and do something that would be absolutely crazy. I might if you really wanted me to, but I try to guard against that when I use social media.
All right, so put you on the spot. Did you have to learn through personal experience? I mean, learn from mistakes what the boundaries were?
Yeah, well, here is the deal. When I started out on Twitter, some of you have heard me say this before, when I started out on Twitter, I had a personal account and a professional account, and they started talking to each other because I wanted, my personal life so wanted to be part of my professional life and vice versa. So I had to find a way to combine the two and really strike a balance for myself in defining who I wanted to be when I was using social media.
Okay, so that's a little bit about what I think the conversation tonight is about. I mean, can you be more specific? How do you blend those two but make it safe so you don't lose your job, you know, or lose your friends? What do you think, like legally?
Well, anything you post, do it with, and we've heard this from the other speakers, do it with the assumption that it's going to be read by someone who you may not intend it to be read by. Employers are basically interested in you doing three things online. Number one, disclosing their confidential or proprietary information. Number two, embarrassing yourself in such a way that people who know you work there are going to think less of you and the company as a result of that. Or three, using the social media as a way to harass or defame or discriminate against coworkers or customers or other people as well. So, you know, if you can stay away from those three general areas, you know, you're probably going to be okay. And, you know, I don't want to discount by giving these horror stories here the fact that employers should and do, and we encourage them to think about the positive aspects of social media. I mean, you don't want policies and procedures and behaviors on your part as an employer that squelch or really limit the very useful things that, you know, Twitter and Facebook and these other sites can do for your business. And you don't want to so deter employees from doing that that you're missing out on the benefits from it.
It sounds like there's almost a like a maturation process that happens for adults who will, I think teens are probably, kids are a different story, but for adults, when they get on this, I mean, I know just in the last 24 hours, I'm a new, like I said, I've just started tweeting, and I, every single time I write something, I feel like I have to decide, I have to be very conscious about it, and then I sort of get caught up in it, and then all of a sudden I'm tweeting something that's like maybe a little more personal, and then I sort of think, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Like, you kind of have to learn as you go. So I mean, what's the rule of thumb? How do you, Danny, Jonathan, how do you decide where the boundary is? Like, what's the thing that like sets your radar off and tells you to hit delete?
I think that's going to be different for everyone. You know, honestly, it really is going to depend on your personal comfort level, your industry. I mean, I know that for medical professionals, for teachers, like Jonathan mentioned, there are liability issues, and some of the risks and some of the stakes are a little bit higher because of their position. I think personally with myself, you know, I'm really pretty comfortable with sharing a lot of information online. But you also have to be able to distinguish the difference between what is personal and what gives your audience and the folks that you're engaging with a little bit more information, a little more insight into who you are and what you're about, and what is actually private and information that you're just not comfortable sharing publicly. I know, you know, one thing for me is just relationship status. I don't have that on my Facebook. I don't tweet about it on Twitter. That's something to me that's a private part of my life that I'd like to keep off the web.
Yeah, I agree. The issue that you're raising, Julie, is digital and media literacy. And it's a question of our ability to be able to process information that we receive online and to be able to produce that information and send something out online. And the big concern is sharing information that should be kept private is the question that we're raising. And the answer for me is that I I try my best to tweet and do Facebook professionally in a manner that I think is befitting of what I do. For me, that's a little bit more flexible than, say, for Jonathan, who's a lawyer, because I'm an academic and I work at a university. So I have a little more flexibility than people in other industries might. But it is very much related to who you are, what you do, what you value, how you see yourself, and what you're willing to share and what you're willing to produce in an online space.
I'm going to remind you to be thinking of your questions, and we've got, let's have Jared raise your hand, Jared back here, and Tina over here with microphones. So as a question comes, please raise your hand, and they'll come find you, and we'd love to add your voice to the conversation. Is there a place for people who only take and don't give in social media? Here's what I mean. For the last several months, I have a Facebook. I actually have a login. People ask to friend me. I have no profile. I have no friends on Facebook. The only reason I have a login on Facebook is to find out information about other people, what is out there that's public, because you have to log in order to go. You know, when you hear someone say that they've got these pictures or whatever, there's enough public information that I'm only there taking. Twitter, I do a lot more following of other people's tweets than of tweeting myself. So is there room for that? And can people here in the audience who are maybe a little reticent about crossing that line, can they just take and not give?
Absolutely. I think, you know, you have to learn. The literacy issue is typically that you have to learn how to read before you learn how to write. And so we find that a lot of people who are getting into media of any kind learn how to process that information and take the time to think about it and find out what in that information is compelling and what isn't before they start to share themselves. I think there's totally a place for that.
Yeah, and I think that that's, you know, where we would recommend that most people start. Forrester Research did a study recently that, you know, how people were consuming web content and how they're interacting on the web. And I think something like 80% of individuals are actually what they qualified as lurkers, just folks that are out there. They've subscribed via RSS. They're following you on Twitter. They're, you know, reading your updates and posts in social networks, but they're not actually responding and engaging. And really only, you know, that the rest of that 20% of our folks who are sending out tweets and content, even a smaller portion are creating content, like writing blog posts and things. So
can you get the full benefit? Can you get the full benefit out of it if you're just lurking? That seems like a pretty low risk, you know, way to go about it.
You can get a lot of information. You know, initially when I joined Twitter, that was one of the reasons, because I realized that I wanted to become more involved in communications in Charlotte and find a job in marketing and PR. Saw that there were some pretty prominent, well-known people in the community that were in that space, and they were sharing information on the web about what they were reading, what events they were attending. And so I just started following them, thinking, you know, okay, I'm going to get an education here for free. And then an opportunity came up to have a conversation with some of those folks, and I realized, you know, this is maybe not as intimidating as it looks, and just kind of grew from there.
I just saw a post up here. I want to point out Scott Hepburn is reminding us that your tweets show up in the Google search results, which I actually didn't realize. So Google search results that may even be the number one result for your name. So, Jonathan, you were talking earlier about employers looking for information. I mean, how common is it for people in this market when they're applying for a job for the employer to be looking them up online?
You know, it's less common than you think. There are some real good legal reasons, excuse me, why employers don't want information about applicants beyond what they're getting on the application. For instance, if you go on someone's Facebook page and you learn that they have a disease or a medical condition and you decide not to hire that person, you typically don't want to know that type of information. You can't ask them directly during the hiring process, but if you find it out through going online, you know, you kind of become pregnant with that knowledge, and if you're accused of discriminating or not hiring them because of that, it can cause you some problems. So it's not as prevalent as you think. Usually where the information comes to human resources is not because of somebody in HR who's going out and searching. It's because one of their coworkers brings it to HR's attention. They're mad at them. Mm-hmm. There's some feud going on in the workplace. I mean, once a month I get a call from an employer who says, an HR professional who says, you know, so-and-so just emailed me somebody's Facebook page and said, can you believe what this person was doing over the weekend? Or guess who got arrested for drunk driving over the weekend? Or guess who was just put on the sexual offender registry? What are you going to do about it?
So it's and what can an employer do about it at that point?
Well, you know, it depends on the circumstances. You know, the employer has to make a determination as to whether that behavior is something that impacts the job. Quite oftentimes it doesn't. And the employer says, you know, that's interesting. More power to the employee. If it does appear to be something that has a relationship to the job, it may be time to bring the employee in. It may be time to warn him. If it's something egregious, it may be time to make a change in terms of those employees. But usually it's your coworkers ratting you out. It's not the company intentionally searching for that information.
And that, you know, we've heard about some businesses who try to who maybe ban the access to Facebook or whatever at work, or, you know, prohibit you from tweeting with any affiliation to the business, you know, try to set these boundaries to avoid having their own corporate name besmirched. But it sounds like there is just really no way for a business to not have its employee, to not also run the risk the minute that an employee is involved in social media, these kinds of things are at risk of coming up.
Yeah. Now, I have never seen an employer that absolutely banned its employees from presence on social networking inside or outside of work. A lot of employers ban Facebook access because they view it as an enormous time waster, not because they're necessarily concerned about what's being posted there. But we advise, and most employers now are coming up with social networking policies, and we really suggest that you sit down and talk with your employees about what the company's expectations are, what the employee's expectations are, and try to come up with a set of general rules that everybody has access to and is playing from the same page on that, and to try to avoid surprises or circumstances where the employee said, well, nobody told me this was going to be a problem. So I think that's a really helpful tool that employers can use to try to diffuse and to try to come to an understanding with their employees as to what's appropriate and what isn't.
So, Danny, you work for Fairpoint Communications, senior social media strategist. Mm-hmm. Is that part of what you are? I mean, what are some of the lessons you can share, I guess, coming from that corporate perspective?
It is absolutely it. And actually, right now, we're in the process of getting the social media policy approved. Some recent developments, I guess, around that, and Jonathan could probably speak to this a little bit more in depth than I could, but the National Labor Relations Board has recently turned the attention to this issue based on an employee who worked with American Medical Response, which is an ambulance company, who was let go because of a Facebook post and then turned around and decided to, you know, sue the company for wrongful termination. The National Labor Relations Board intervened on her behalf and really determined that her behavior in social networks, which I think was Facebook, was where she was posting, fell under what they consider to be concerted speech, which is basically just protecting an employee's right to talk to another employee about work-related things. So that's something that we've had to kind of recognize, but I think at the same time, you know, companies have to realize that your social media policy is not just in place to protect the organization and the company.
Right.
It's also, you know, a lot of folks don't realize some of the privacy settings on these social networks, and Facebook is actually notorious for changing those kind of midstream, unannounced, and releasing your private information publicly to the web. And, you know, competitors can view that information, news media can view that information, and some of your employees, based on what they've posted, if it's controversial or if it's, you know, something kind of a hot-button issue, can end up on the 11 o'clock news.
Yeah.
So you want to be able to, you know, protect your employees and educate them as well.
So just can you share with us an example of the kinds of things that would be in a policy like this? Maybe Jonathan or Danny?
It can vary from company to company, but what you typically tell employees is that, you know, we have the right and we do monitor this, and while we encourage your appropriate use of this, we think it's a good idea, there are some circumstances where it's inappropriate for you to make postings or to share things that are just inconsistent with your employment status. And the three things I had mentioned previously are what are covered. You know, it's confidential information, embarrassing information, or harassing type behavior. Some companies want pre-approval of tweets, or they want pre-approval of postings that are made. If you have a blog, they want you to clearly state in your blog that this is your personal opinion and that this is not representative of the company, or it's not the opinion of the company. So depending on the employer and the industry and the circumstances, there are a lot of different things you can have in it. But what I really encourage employers to do is, before you put the policy out, talk with your employees, you know, hold roundtable discussions, solicit especially people under 30 who have a different perspective typically than your executives in the company, and make sure that everyone's on the same page in terms of what the expectations are.
So, John, what are some of the biggest mistakes do you think people make when they decide to go onto social media?
Well, I think there's two, and they're on opposite ends of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. The first biggest mistake that you can make when you go on social media is to try to update everyone with what you're doing at every point in your life, which is terrible.
Isn't that what Twitter's supposed to be, though?
No. Well,
what are you doing right now?
Right? That's the misconception, that you're supposed to go in and say, well, this morning for breakfast, I had a croissant. But I think that's a problem, and people can use it that way and certainly have great opportunity to develop friendships and social connections by doing that. I don't choose to follow those people. On Twitter, I think you're much better off. You know, one of the questions up here is, how often do you post? That I've seen rolling by. I think you have to post at least once per day to stay relevant at all. But how often to post is based upon your purpose. And I think that's the other issue, is that we see people who get onto Twitter and they get so freaked out and frightened by what's going on that they don't post at all. And so it's nice to find, to strike a balance, to figure out when your people are listening to you on Twitter, and how often you're going to be retweeted, how often are people going to notice your tweet and respond to your question. That's just a trial and error issue that people can try for themselves.
Remember, raise your hand if you have any questions. I can't believe that nobody here would have any questions, so please feel free, whatever, or even if it's just a comment, we'll come to you. And let me, so we've got one up here in the front. Let me just add to that, John, do you think that it's, because we start hearing, I know I'm hearing some of the horror stories, you know, and I'm thinking, then I need to be as bland as possible in my tweets. But then what good is that, right? I mean, no one's going to follow you. So in terms of trying to sort of like be interesting, I guess, or have, you know, I mean, how do you walk that line and not, you know, not being too bland, I guess, but staying safe?
Well, I wouldn't call myself interesting. Some people in the audience might take an issue with that. But I think that, you know, what you do is try to figure out what niche you want. I mean, you make a voice for yourself. It's the same thing as if you're writing a book or you're writing an email. You make a voice for yourself, and you speak in that voice, mm-hmm. and you share things that voice would be sharing. And that's different from who you are personally, but it's the same as who you are personally as well. So finding that voice is really important to developing a presence on Twitter. I think that's what people follow, are voices that they hear that have something to contribute, that have a personal interest to them. I mean, Justin Bieber is really fun to follow on Twitter if you like that particular kind of voice. And he's we saw up here earlier, he's the second most followed person on Twitter.
Number two.
So it depends on the voice and what you find value in.
We have a question down here, a comment.
Hi, good evening. My question is about, I think, a lot of people that I'm meeting that are borderline Gen Y and above are very aware of the need to have a social media presence. And it's, I think, making that delicate balance between public and private, but also using it in a way to kind of engage members of the public if you're creating like a community event, or trying to draw in members of the public for, you know, maybe not so much for for really kind of creating some energy for maybe perhaps an idea or an organization. Can you touch on a little bit about, what are the best approaches for that? I mean, what is there too much of a public presence with social media? Is that an appropriate place for something like that, where it's not so much about yourself on the web, but you as part of a movement or trying to make some change?
So, Danny, I think you'd be great to handle that. Just you tweet on behalf of Fairpoint Communications, don't you?
I do.
So, because, and I guess the issue is, I mean, I have followed and then promptly unfollowed a lot of corporate feeds because it's just boring or too self-promoting, you know? So, mm-hmm. So what's the secret to being relevant in that way?
You know, I think actually John touched on, I mean, just number one, to be authentic. I know that's kind of a very vague statement to make, but it's one of the most remarkable things to me about the social web is really its ability to aggregate like minds and to connect you with people who actually are going to care about what you have to say, so long as you're saying it in a way that's authentic and really genuine to your cause. You know, people in social media are usually pretty good at calling you out if your intentions are not the best. We've seen that recently with the tweet, I don't know if anyone had seen it, from Kenneth Cole regarding the situation in Cairo. They sent out a tweet from their Twitter account that said, there's an uprising in Cairo today. Word must have gotten out about our spring line. Here's a URL for our e-commerce site. So that was kind of a pretty public slip-up. And, you know, within minutes, it was they were talking about it in the Huffington Post. It was really, you know, all over the place. And a lot of folks on Twitter were sort of up in arms because they were offended by that comment. So I think, you know, things like that can happen. You have to be able to use good judgment. But if you do make a mistake, you know, if you've been approaching your community in an authentic way, and then you go back and circle back and apologize and say, you know, that was pretty dumb on my part, people will be likely to forgive you. So it's be authentic. That would be my one.
Be willing to kind of take the risk a little bit, be right. You know, not be too stale, but also acknowledge that if you're going to make mistakes, if you're taking that risk.
But it's also about, and by the way, Danny wrote a wonderful blog post about the Kenneth Cole thing, so if you haven't checked out our website, you should check it out. But it's about being authentic, and it's about finding a voice and a mission for a particular Twitter feed. So if you're working for a company trying to establish a Twitter feed for that particular company, then that company Twitter has to be authentic apart from the people that are also tweeting that work for the company. One of the biggest mistakes that I see companies make is having a person in charge of social media who tweets out on behalf of the company all of their personal issues. And that's a problem. And it's a problem that happens a lot. So it's about finding a mission for that Twitter feed. Who is the audience? Who is the public that is going to be listening to this Twitter feed? And what do they care about? That's what you should be tweeting about.
We have a couple of questions that have come through on our feed up here, actually, and I'm going to aim these at you, Jonathan. So this one's from Scott Hepburn. Are employer efforts to ban social media sites on workplace computers effective in the smartphone era?
No. It's a way to get around. You know, most employers now also have Wi-Fi within their offices, and you see more and more iPads coming in as well that are being used to try to get around those policies. So it's a Band-Aid approach, but you know, there are more effective ways for employers to figure out whether or not their employees are spending their time productively or not.
And from Train and Educate, whoever that is out there in the audience, what recourse do individuals have if they are reprimanded for flubs on social media?
If you work for a private employer, not much in North Carolina. It's an at-will employment state, meaning that the employer can discipline or terminate you for any reason as long as it's not a clearly illegal reason. If you work for a government employer, you have some more rights regarding free speech and some constitutional protections, and you may have a recourse there. You know, rather than legal recourse, I would think about internal recourse, going up the chain of management, talking to human resources, trying to explain what happened. I think that's probably more effective than the legal stuff.
Okay, we've got a question over here.
Yeah, I also teach IT and social media, and to some degree have to kind of force myself to do things I might not otherwise do because I need to know what I'm doing. And, you know, so what I've discovered, and I'm very interested in the human-computer interaction, is that 20 years ago, if you wanted to tweet, it was called spray paint in a wall, right? And now it's
also
pretty much...
Also called vandalism.
Well, it all depends on which wall, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, at UVA, there's a wall, a Jefferson wall, where you can write anything in chalk, and it's cleaned every day. So, but the way to express is much easier now, but it still has a long way to go. I still have to type on a keyboard. What I've discovered is as the cameras get better, I'm now much more inclined to take a shot just through the day that's relevant to something and upload it, because there's now an upload button right next to the picture, right on the phone, on the camera. So, but we still have a long way to go, and I envision in the near future you're driving your car listening to the news and there's a tweet button on your mirror of your car or on the radio that just retweets a segment of that article with your audio commentary, you know, switched to voice. So at what point does it just become an endless cloud of just almost like if we could read everyone's mind in this room of meaningless drivel or, you know, pointed commentary?
What do you think?
I think there are people out there who would say that that's now on Twitter.
And that's a good thing?
Well, and that you get to pick what you listen to. And I think that's really the ultimate thing about Twitter is that you don't... Yeah, there's millions of people who tweet, but you don't listen to all of them. You listen to the people that are relevant to you. So for me, yeah, I mean, there's this cloud of information that's going on where people are tweeting things that I don't care about, but I also don't read them or listen to them. So I don't know. I guess that kind of answers the question, but not really.
But isn't there also, though, I mean, a compulsion component to this? I mean, I feel like there are a lot of these feeds that I'll see. I mean, it just sucks you in on Twitter. Like I say, I only do that. I don't do Facebook, so I can't even talk about that. But I'd love to hear from some of you. But just that I mean, sometimes there are these feeds that are going so fast that I feel like if I'm not watching it at every moment, that I'm going to miss part of the conversation. And then if I stick my toe in, then I'm going to get swept away. And so I almost just feel like it's better if I just turn it off and ignore it, you know? So, I mean, do you have any suggestions for people who are just a little overwhelmed with everything that's going by?
I think, you know, with Twitter and with Facebook, that you have the ability to build lists. That's definitely just one of the best features that they've come out with in my mind, because as your social networks begins to scale and you make more and more connections or you start to follow more folks, you have to have a way to be able to organize them and, like you said, you know, sort of keep up with those conversations. On both platforms, they have what is called a stream. So on Facebook, it's your news feed, your news stream, and on Twitter, it's literally just your Twitter stream. The reason that they use the stream analogy is because you're not expected to keep up with everything. There's really no human way possible. It would be like trying to get in your kayak, paddle for a little while, get out, and get back in and catch up to wherever the water ended, you know, so that you didn't miss anything. It's just, you're going to miss points in the conversation, but, you know, your network and your community will help to alert you of anything that's really pertinent and I guess that you need to pay attention to. And one way to do that would be to help organize those folks in lists.
Absolutely, and I think one of the other issues that relates to this issue of the stream is that, and those of you who aren't on Twitter are watching the Twitter fall behind us and saying, what are they writing about? That doesn't make any sense. And part of the issue with Twitter is learning how to read the language of Twitter, understanding what the different signs and symbols mean so that you can just rattle off what people are talking about. It's a really big task to do, and there are guides online that can help you learn how to do that. Do a quick Google search for a field guide to Twitter or something to help you learn the language and try to figure that out.
Get a kid to explain it to you, maybe.
Yeah. Well, there's one on my blog if anybody wants to check it out.
There you go.
And I think to his particular question, you know, some of the interesting things that I've been reading about lately, and I'm just going to take it like uber nerd for a minute. So who has seen the movie Avatar? Anybody? In Avatar, one of the most interesting things is that, you know, the main character is able to plug into this make-believe world and then kind of jump out and seamlessly transition between the two. And I really think that's an interesting analogy for how folks will be interacting with web going forward. There have been some recent developments with location-based networking platforms and you know, specifically with this new technology called near-field communications, where it's basically functions like an RFID chip. You use your mobile phone, you can walk up to the chip and, you know, touch it to your phone, and all of a sudden you have this extra added layer of information. Hmm. So hypothetically, and it hasn't been rolled out much in the U.S. yet, it's mostly in Japan, but you could be in the movie theater, you could walk up to a movie poster, hold your mobile phone up to it, and then it would show you on your mobile phone the preview, you know, the video preview for that movie. So I think that, you know, going forward, as these technologies are more advanced, you know, we'll just naturally be transitioning between web-based communications and offline communications, and that's sort of where all of this stuff is heading, in my mind.
And we'll always, perhaps, Jonathan, have to be negotiating what the privacy legal liability lines are, I would think, yeah, along the way.
And it just continues to be an evolving area of the law. The case Danny mentioned out of Connecticut, the ambulance company, I mean, they're trying to interpret a law that was written in 1933 and to apply it to social media use. So the lawyers and the government and the folks who are dealing with the intersections of these areas aren't sure how this is all going to work out, and it's just going to continue to evolve as the technology evolves.
Before we go to another question here, I do want to just cover one that went by in the Twitter fall. Is that what we call that, the Twitter fall? Okay. So Kat Kramer in the audience asked, I don't actually even understand what this question is. So are tailored Facebook ads an invasion of privacy or an enhanced online experience? So first of all, what's a tailored Facebook ad?
The idea behind Facebook ads is that ads, the marketers can tell, well, Facebook can tell where you are clicking. When you click on something online, you can be followed. And every website does this. Amazon has been doing it for years. You've probably noticed if you ever shopped on Amazon, it shows you at the bottom things you recently looked at or things that other people bought that looked at the same thing that you looked at. And so it's a tool that the website is using to be able to not only track what you do, but to suggest things that might be of interest to you. Is that an invasion of privacy? The answer is, well, maybe, but it's also really smart. I mean, it's a great marketing strategy to try to figure out what are you interested in and how can I tailor my message to you. One of my favorite examples of this is in Back to the Future 2. Marty McFly walks up and he sees this advertisement come out at him, and it's very much tailored to the fact that he's there. And I think this is what we're seeing advertising going toward, a model that is more personal, that is directed at people who are interested in a particular topic. And from a marketing perspective, that's a good thing. From a personal privacy perspective, well, I mean, you clicked on it, so.
Yeah, so Jonathan, I mean, from a legal perspective, how is it possible that a company can be basically, I guess, reading my interests and, you know, giving me advertising as a result?
Like John said, you clicked on it. When you signed up for that website, you accepted terms and conditions, all that legal stuff that no one ever reads. You basically give away the rights for them to compile that information, to use it, to sell it in many circumstances as well, and that is a term and condition of your visiting their site and using their services. So you've consented to it whether you read that small print or not.
I think what's, I guess, a little bit more hidden, though, underneath all those layers. So with Facebook ads, you know, you can target certain demographics or geographic locations and those advertisements that you purchase, which show up in the right rail of your Facebook page, will be just only shown to that specific group. But in 2010, Facebook also rolled out something called the Open Graph, which you've seen on a website. Someone can include the like button. Mm-hmm. So you can click on that and actually like their Facebook page. It'll take you there. Any website that has that content, that Facebook like functionality, is actually Facebook's pulling information about user behavior on that site back into their platform. So likely, Facebook has more information about behavioral and statistical things, you know, on my generation than even the government right now. That's why we'll see definitely this privacy issue and, you know, develop over the next year in the legal realm in particular, because the technology is advancing so quickly that it's almost like, you know, we're trying to keep up with the social implications.
Maybe I should just explain very quickly. I'm coming back here. The reason I'm not on Facebook is not because I don't know how to use it, but just because I don't want the whole world to find me and then I have to navigate all of these. I don't want to have to make these decisions. It's just too much work. So mostly it's because I'm lazy. And I don't know if anyone else out in the audience, I'd love to hear from you if you also have made a conscious decision not to do Facebook. But let's go back here to the back.
Thank you. And this is going to return to something a few moments ago. The concept of someone being offended at someone at Kenneth Cole posting a witticism is really interesting. I believe it reflects back on the assumptions that people who use social media have about it, that it's their tribe, that someone should not post what they don't want. And that's almost magical thinking, that somehow it's already proscribed that someone should not trip and do what they choose to do. It should only be what they, the readers, would like to have read.
So is it a little bit elite, this whole social media thing? There's an elitism?
I don't think so. You know, I think that media overall is experiencing this. We find people, in terms of news media, choosing to watch Fox News for a particular viewpoint, or choosing to watch CNN or MSNBC for a particular viewpoint. And that kind of mentality of watching things that you like and avoiding things that you don't like, which is called cognitive dissonance, that concept is related to the issues of people having biases and feeling like they have to have their own opinion and their own opinion should be valued. So it's a societal issue for sure that we have this issue where people feel like they can be on one polarizing end and they have the right to voice that concern at any time that they would like, and they can share it with the entire world. Fantastic. Not so fantastic because everyone else has to hear it.
And I think there are a lot of satirical Twitter accounts. I mean, The Onion actually is an online website that, you know, very satirical and writes some controversial and even sometimes cheeky things and is very, you know, well-read. But to me, where that slip happened with Kenneth Cole was they were actually trying to take that conversation that was happening around Cairo and make money off of it, because they posted a link to their e-commerce site. So I think that was the thing in particular that people were offended. Not that they were, you know, making light of the situation or that it was a joke, but that they were trying to draw some of that traffic back to their e-commerce site to make money.
And that was that's the issue of finding a mission and finding a voice for your Twitter feed. And the issue for Kenneth Cole was that Kenneth Cole was not a satirical Twitter feed, and right. Yet all of a sudden made this witticism that they wouldn't normally make. And that's the issue. It's having that authentic voice, that mission, that constant voice. And when you do something that is against that voice, people notice.
Just that raises a question for me, Jonathan, along the lines of sort of freedom of speech. I mean, is there slander and libel? Is there a concern? I mean, when I'm saying something and I'm being sarcastic maybe, but it's a little bit of a dig at somebody else and I do it on Twitter, and then I somehow like could potentially be in trouble for slandering?
Yeah, you could. There was an article today, I can't remember whether it was in The Observer or whether it was online, about a company going after someone who posted a negative review on Yelp or one of the consumer review websites, and basically getting hold of that user and threatening to sue them for libel unless they remove the negative review from their site. The same rules apply for libel and slander that would apply to any communication would also apply to online communications. I think some people feel that there's an anonymity involved in it, or that they're not legally responsible for the statements that they make, but that's not true at all. Now, in most cases, you know, is a business or is an individual going to be motivated and have the financial wherewithal to go after you for that? Probably not. But certainly it has happened, and it's probably going to happen more than we've seen in the past. Free speech, again, only applies to your relations with the government. No one has free speech rights when it applies to dealings with a private employer or another person or a private entity. Free speech is a concept that only applies to your relation to the government controlling your speech.
We've got one over here. Question.
Hi. It's kind of like the 800-pound gorilla question here. I just wanted to ask the panel, how do you feel that social media, how do you feel that it has changed us as human beings in terms of how we act towards each other now since it's been around? you know, our attention span and, you know, how we view each other. I just wanted to hear your opinions on that because I think about it a lot.
Do you think it's made your life better or worse?
It's just changed things a lot. It's like, I've been around for almost 40 years now, and I miss face-to-face talk with people. And it seems like when I do sit down and talk with people, they're too busy, distracted, doing Twitter or something else like that. So it just seems like you can't get somebody's full attention anymore. But maybe it's just my perception. I don't know.
What do you think?
Media theorist Marshall McLuhan felt that technology changed society. And he chronicled different technologies that have caused shifts in society. He talked about the alphabet, the printing press, the ability to communicate electronically through the telegraph. And then he theorized that we would enter this age of the internet, and then we would enter this age that where media would be social. And he thinks that it creates a smaller world, but a world that's more connected, but not to the people near you. But rather, you're connected to people very far away from you who share a like-mindedness, which is what Danny mentioned earlier. It's a connection of like-minded people rather than a connection of me to my neighbor. That's a major shift in the way that we operate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think probably one of the fastest eroding things, you know, because of social media and the social web are geographic boundaries. So we're no longer bound by, you know, our neighborhood or our community geographically, but we can connect with people who are across the country, across the world, and actually have people in my network that, you know, that are located in other places. One of the biggest challenges, and I think sort of a caveat for social media, is that really it's not as impactful as it could be if you're not taking that relationship offline. So, you know, being in Twitter in the Charlotte community has changed my life definitely exponentially, because I moved here in 2006 and lived here for 2.5 years before I joined Twitter. Joined Twitter in 2008. And then just started to follow people and, like I said earlier, you know, really began to interact with them on the web. What that did was to enable those conversations once I saw them in real life. And also, you know, could reach out to them proactively and say, you know, hey, let's go grab coffee. It seems like we might have some things in common. Or, you know, I'd really like to talk to you about X, Y, or Z. So I think taking that online relationship offline is a really important component. But also, like you said, you know, we've all been in a conversation with someone who just can't put their phone down. And really, I don't think that's respectful to your time or, you know, that relationship. So it's have to set those boundaries.
Do you think it's also, I know your question was about relationships and human interaction. I've wondered if it seems like it also, social media has made us more narcissistic. I mean, how much really of Twitter and Facebook is really just exhibitionist, you know? And the fact that it's, you know, exciting to think that you can tell however many people are following you what you had for breakfast and sort of get some, you know? I mean, do you think that, is that a danger? Is that part of what makes this so popular, do you think?
I think that's part of what makes it so addictive. I mean, it's self-validating. You know, I'd be lying if I sat up here and didn't say that, you know, I was excited when people found something that I said interesting or helpful.
And retweeted.
Right, and retweeted
it. Or linked to you or whatever.
But I think, you know, one of the fundamental principles of social media interaction there is that helpfulness and the ability to provide something of value to the people in your network, because likely they're not going to follow you unless that reciprocity is set up. So
sounds like we walk a fine line there. Do we have a comment here? We'll go here first.
Hello?
Okay. There you go.
I'm still in awe that fax machines work. So I'm kind of a dinosaur. But I think, like you, Julie, I'm getting ready to jump off the cliff and do this. My question is, how much time should I budget in a day to, you know, productive tweeting and Facebooking?
And are you interested in doing this sort of professionally, personally, or both?
Probably both.
Yeah. All right. Can he have a life and still do this effectively? How much time do you spend, Jonathan? Do you do it at all?
Not a whole lot. It's LinkedIn. It's Martindale Hubbell Connect, which is a social networking site for attorneys. But it's not more than, 5-10 minutes a day for me.
Danny?
I don't know if I can answer that question fairly. It's my job, so I'm connected almost 24 hours a day. The thing that I would suggest, though, to make it manageable and not overwhelming, is really to let a lot of your social media engagement live and die in your inbox. I funnel a lot of that through my email, so have alerts set up and things, and then. When email first was launched, it really became a problem because people started to get hundreds and hundreds of emails a day, and I'm sure that you do. You just can't possibly answer everything. So what, once you add all these multiple channels of Facebook messages and Twitter messages and SMS, text messaging, you kind of have to have a place where you can put that until you have the time to devote to it. So I would set up folders in your inbox and send that stuff to those folders, and then it's up to you, really. If you can devote 10 minutes a day to jump in and check in to see if anyone's said anything interesting that you want to respond to, then that's great. If it's an hour a week, you might see that as you find and develop that purpose there, that'll start to grow. But, making it manageable is one of the biggest challenges.
And if you're looking to set a limit or kind of keep it in check, maybe don't get a smartphone, because then you've always got it in your pocket and it's impossible right. to stop checking. What would you say is the perfect amount of time to really, really do it well but not have it take over?
I mean, for me personally, I probably average an hour and a half to maybe 2 hours a day. But I also have times when I go to the beach with my family and I lock my iPhone in the safe and I don't look at it. Because you can put it away. That's part of the beauty of having it on your smartphone, is being able to turn your smartphone off. And that's fine. I think, for me, starting out is going to be a lot, you're going to think that it's a lot harder than it is as you find out how it's best for you to manage it. Like Danny, I funnel things to my email. If someone mentions me on Twitter, funnels to my email. Or, for example, if I see an article that comes across Twitter that I really want to read but I don't have time to do that, I'll email it to myself so that I can take time to go back and read that later when it's convenient. Mm-hmm. So part of it is making the schedule work for you in terms of the times that it's convenient.
We'll come back there in just 1 second. A couple of things off the feed I wanted to just cover real quick. Kind of back to the social interaction concept. Does that like-minded factor you were talking about, Danny, with social media, does that actually isolate social groups even more? Because now you can find the people, the three people in the world who like these three things that you enjoy, and why would you hang out with anybody else,
It's funny, I recently read some research about this, and I'm not going to be able to remember where it was, but if anyone emails me afterward, I will track it down and send it to you. But this group did a Facebook study because, part of the fear of Facebook is that you would connect only with people who were like yourself, and then we would start to develop these homogenous communities, and that diversity would kind of go to the wayside. So they did this study on Facebook to find out, through polling people, what they thought that some of their friends and their family members and their connections' opinions on certain topics were. And the results of the poll were surprisingly inaccurate, that even husband-wife, couples couldn't predict what their spouse would really feel about a subject. So it's, on one hand, it's kind of representative of the fact that we make certain assumptions of that like-mindedness of, considering the fact that my friends must be reasonable people, they'll feel the same way that I do about this subject. But the good news is that, that diversity of opinion is not going to the wayside. It's something that still, very much exists. And even in some cases, I would say, I've made connections with folks who I may not have met through offline groups that hold very different opinions from my own because of social media.
I know a lot of people find social media really valuable from a networking professional perspective. And since you mentioned LinkedIn, Jonathan, this is a question, again, that came up on the Twitter feed from Train and Educate. So you're able to let your Twitter feeds be viewed on LinkedIn, which is the professional networking site, right? So does that help or hinder the job seeker if it's professional? You know, is if you are putting your Twitter feeds there on your LinkedIn, which is meant to be, I mean, a lot of job applicants will actually send a potential employer their LinkedIn page. So does that open you to some additional kind of legal concern, or
I don't think so. I mean, and I'm not on Facebook, but LinkedIn just seems to be a different community and a different environment than what I know about Facebook. I mean, it is for people to network business-wise. It's for people to live their professional lives that way. And I don't see a whole lot on LinkedIn that deals with folks' personal lives. And frankly, I think it's a little bit unusual when I do run across something like that.
So you don't have a lot of horror stories related to LinkedIn?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Do you think it helps or hinders? You both have LinkedIn?
Or? I have a LinkedIn profile. Actually,
to put the Twitter feeds on there is the
question. Don't think it's a great idea to put your Twitter feed on another profile because they're for different purposes. I mean, on Facebook, you friend people because it would be really rude of you to not be friends with somebody who actually does know you. So sometimes I don't care what they say, but I'm their friend, you know, and that's great. And on Twitter, you know, I wouldn't have all my Facebook friends have to follow what I'm tweeting about. So I think, you know, each social media platform is for a different purpose. It serves a different purpose, and you should do different things in them. Sometimes they cross over, but only occasionally for me.
There are, with LinkedIn, there are kind of two options for integrating your Twitter stream. One is to have it on your page itself, on your profile page, and I have mine set up that way. The other is to automate it so that all of your tweets are actually showing up as status updates in LinkedIn, which is what John's referencing. That I feel very strongly that you should not do. And the reason is, you know, with that automation in particular, like you said, you're gonna build a different audience in each platform. You're going to have a different relationship with those folks. But not only that, you're more or less just throwing all of these messages out there and giving people so many different options to respond that it's just creating more for you to manage. A lot of, I think, overlap there, and not a reason for people to connect with you specifically on different platforms according to how they'd like to interact. Mm-hmm.
So we need a microphone up here, and we have a question back here.
Good evening. My question was a little bit about going back to the advertising topic earlier. As a small business owner, could you maybe walk through some of the costs associated with establishing a relevant social media presence? And kind of as a second question, how do you measure that return on investment? I mean, TV, you have Nielsen ratings, radio is Arbitron. So what kind of metrics do you use in social media? Thank you.
There's always one that asks the hard questions, right? I knew we were going to get that one.
Oh, good. You came prepared.
With the advertising in particular, you know, social media advertising is a little bit unique because there are you can have different objectives. So I've seen that, you know, folks have done advertising on Facebook to only their Facebook fans, because you can really specifically target to, you know, whichever group you're trying to reach, to offer those folks a special promotion. And so then obviously you'd measure, you know, well, how many people are clicking on that ad and actually purchasing, right? But you can also run an advertising campaign on Facebook just for brand awareness. Say your company launches a blog like we're actually about to do within the next few months here at Fairpoint. We've looked at, you know, running some Facebook promotions just to drive traffic back to that blog and start to get people engaged in the conversation. So I think your metrics are really going to be determined by your overall goals and objectives and what you're looking to accomplish there. Is that specific enough?
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of how much it costs, it really is a labor cost for the amount of time that you're going to spend, especially if you're a small business. So the idea for small businesses is to devote some time to it and figure out what you need. In terms of return on investment, it's a mathematical equation. You divide how much you spend by how much you make. And it's hard to know how much you make because of social media click-throughs. For small businesses, many of the companies that do social media monitoring recommend that small businesses use a Google Analytics tool, which is free. But there are businesses that can sell you wonderful software that you can find. If you go to Social Media Club Charlotte, there's several businesses that advertise there that talk or that have spoken as well at Social Media Charlotte events that sell their product for monitoring your hits and clicks and click-throughs online.
Let's take a question back here.
With like Facebook and all the social media accounts, how do you control what other people are posting about you? Like with like the smartphone where someone takes a picture and then they post a picture of you guys at a bar. Like how do you, I guess, damage control that?
So from a personal perspective, you can set up your Facebook privacy settings so that people can't see photos that you're tagged in. Probably also a good idea just to give your friends a heads up that if you're dancing on the bar, you don't really necessarily want to be tagged on those pictures in Facebook. But from a brand perspective, it's interesting because I get that question a lot from, you know, folks who are like, well, what if people are posting negative things on our Facebook pages? You know, why would we want to open up that space for them to come and say bad things about our company? And I always answer that question, well, chances are they're going to be doing it anyway. If they feel strongly enough to post, they'll be somewhere else on the web. The advantage of having them on your page is to, you know, have the opportunity to respond to that and address it, and then for other people and other potential customers to see that you've dealt with it in a positive way. So.
Yeah, I think we tend to get all passive-aggressive about social media and not want to ruffle any feathers, but it's perfectly fine. And you should call your brother and say, dear brother, you have posted this picture that I don't think is appropriate for me on Facebook, and I would like for you to take it off.
Just in terms of the legal boundaries there, so in that instance, someone else has posted something that's incriminating. Does that have legal ramifications for me?
You know, it does. Now, whether somebody will find it and use it to get you in trouble or not, I don't know. I do know that it is notoriously difficult to get the social media sites themselves to take action if you complain to them or report to them that there's been an abuse or someone is faking you, a fake profile on Facebook or something like that, and that they don't appear to be very well set up to, in a timely manner, deal with that. Hmm. You know, So
cross your fingers your boss doesn't see it,
I guess. Yeah, you know, the law is just, in a lot of ways, it's not a great remedy, and getting a lawyer or threatening to sue them or something like that just isn't going to be effective. I think more the damage control that John and Danny are talking about here is probably a better way to go about trying to deal with it than threatening to sue somebody.
Mm-hmm. Question up here in the front, or a comment.
Hi. Earlier this year, or last year, the Alliance for Digital Equality Summit came to Johnson C. Smith, which is a group that is trying to close the gaps between underprivileged and underserved communities, getting back to your point about diversity, Danny. There was some discussions about how there are some employers that are shifting their focus from posting positions that are available from the traditional newspaper job boards like Monster or Career Builder and going to posting them exclusively on social media, so Facebook, Twitter, because, you know, it's inexpensive to do that. And there's also some discussion around the fact that these groups of folks don't have access to those jobs because they don't have access to social media or any other type of media. So I wanted to get your thoughts, sir, about encouraging or what advice you would give to small business or businesses in general about doing that, yes or no. And also from a diversity standpoint in terms of marketing, again, being mindful of the fact that there are groups of people that don't have access. Like to hear your opinions, Danny and John, about what you as a strategist and also telling businesses or small businesses as well keeping that in mind, you know, what advice would you provide for them?
You know, years ago, we used to tell employers, if you have a diversity strategy and you're trying to put it into effect, the worst thing you can do is hire the friends and relatives of people who already work for you. That's a guaranteed strategy for making sure you're never going to reach your diversity goals. I think what you're talking about is kind of a digital equivalent of that, which is posting your openings on sites or in ways that are likely to perpetuate the existing demographics you've got in your workplace. Legally, is it a problem to do that? Probably not, unless you're a federal government contractor. If that's the case, there's some additional requirements that you have to go through in terms of your affirmative action plan. But just from a practical standpoint, if you are trying to diversify, if you're trying to implement a strategy like so many employers are these days, you still, I think, have to continue looking at multiple ways to attract qualified applicants. I still think you need to go through the Employment Security Commission. I still think you need to go through the Armed Services recruitment people that help people who are coming out of the military get jobs. I think there are a lot of resources and alternative ways that you can look to get a very diverse pool of applicants for your company. And I think that using one strategy and one strategy only to do it's not going to help get you there.
Absolutely, I agree. I think that, you know, what Jonathan is speaking to really is a multifaceted approach to be able to utilize digital channels, but also to have a little bit more lean on those traditional channels as well. One of the things that, with my company, that I'm particularly proud of is that we are an incumbent local exchange carrier, which means that we're required to roll out broadband internet access in, you know, more or less rural areas that wouldn't otherwise have access. We're primarily a provider in northern New England and just recently have hit our target goals for last year to roll out broadband to 85% of New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. So I think that it's kind of a collective that, you know, at the same time that we're really being aware of some of these issues and the audiences and the voices that we're not hearing on the web, we need to continue to advance access to the internet because it's just such an important thing for education in this company, for the workforce. You know, it definitely, that's a great question and a very pertinent issue.
We've got a question up here for a microphone. I think we've got one back here.
Hi, yes, I'm trained in Educate, and I am curious for the simple fact of brand marketing an individual company, a franchise, or even, do you need me to stand up?
No, yeah.
Again, that's not
there
a problem.
There we go, now we can see it.
The importance of brand marketing yourself, not only in the social space, but also on LinkedIn. That's why I asked the question about using Twitter within your job search. I'm a Twitter teacher at ProNet Charlotte here in Charlotte, helping individuals in transition finding new career paths or obtaining employment in similar fields. And so for me, to hear you say that you wouldn't use Twitter within your job search and put it on your Twitter feed, isn't that kind of going against LinkedIn Signal, the program where you can go on and see the Twitter feeds from various people that you might be following or different companies and be able to have the open dialogue with that person within an interview? Or even showing yourself as a brand leader by having certain articles, information, and other things and pointing out to a potential employer.
Absolutely.
Not your brand. So that's why I was just a little confused and I wanted to just clarify my question.
Thank you.
I think that's a good question. What I feel that your Twitter stream should be there on LinkedIn, that it gives people another channel to hear your voice, and especially when you're a job seeker, you know, that's an important thing, that you've sort of developed this web presence and that your employer can hear your expertise. I know that Jonathan kind of highlighted some of the challenges and issues with that. The thing that I don't typically support or I guess encourage is to just automate that setup. So there's a way for you to push every single tweet that you ever send out to LinkedIn. And I don't think that that's appropriate because sometimes you're going to be having conversations on Twitter that if you send that post to LinkedIn and it's your updated status, there's really no context there, and so people wouldn't necessarily understand it. So I think it's just being cognizant of the fact that there's going to be different use cases for each network, and not just blasting it out everywhere because that's easy. Right, exactly. For the folks that didn't hear that in the audience, so if you're new to Twitter and you use a hashtag, it's basically the number sign, pound sign. And if you end a tweet with pound IN, it'll be sent to your LinkedIn page. If you end it with pound FB, it'll be sent to your Facebook as a status update. So that's another way to kind of pick and choose what's appropriate for those channels and what you want to cross-promote.
Okay, so right here. Where is it? Oh, there it is.
Yeah. I just wanted to add something to what the panel said to a question that was asked earlier about metrics and being able to track how effective social media is if you have a commercial website. Mm-hmm. And Google Analytics is fantastic. I think you may have to have a Gmail account or something, but it gives you tremendous analytics. You'll see where your traffic is coming from, what page they're visiting. If you sign up for keywords, you'll see what words people are searching and finding you on. So I would highly recommend that.
Good. Thank you. Question here.
Hi, I'm at You Decide. Following Julie Rose. Maybe I should stop following her since she's not a big believer. Anyway, I have just a quick comment and then a question for the attorney. When I joined Twitter, there were 68,000 users, and it used to be much more socially engaging than it is today. What I have found is over the last 3 years, 3+ years, it has grown into a hyping platform for a lot of people who do what I call me tweets or look at me tweet. It seems to me it's loaded with people trying to get a voice out there about themselves as opposed to some sort of social networking. And this is why I believe also that Twitter is now valued at $10 billion because they see it as a great marketing tool now, with all the retweeting that's going on and so on. One more comment. For anybody who's not on Twitter, if you're looking for a good social network, Goodreads is all about reading and connecting with people who like to read. And anybody who's been on Twitter and has gotten away from it and started to read books again, it's quite a psychological adjustment. Anyway, here's my question. What do you think is going to happen with all of us in this audience who may have clicked on the WikiLeaks Twitter connection, and is our government going to be able to pull all of our messages off of Twitter that we've either sent to them or connected up with Julian Assange and so on? What's your view on that legally?
Are you saying if you're like a follower of the Twitter feed, the WikiLeaks?
If you follow it or you've sent messages, anybody who's connected up with WikiLeaks on Twitter, their messages, their direct messages and at messages are now up for grabs by the U.S. government.
Unless you're a member of the Armed Forces or a State Department employee, I don't think I'd lose too much sleep over it. That's one of the areas where the First Amendment still does apply. And I don't think that the government's going to be able to do much of anything in terms of people accessing those websites.
The Library of Congress has been archiving tweets for several years now. So if you are tweeting, all your tweets are located at the Library of Congress, and you can go check yourself out. I did want to mention that WikiLeaks is a great topic, and there's an event at Queen's University of Charlotte this Thursday night where the lead reporter from the New York Times is coming to speak about this exact issue that you're speaking on, the right to privacy versus the public's right to know.
So it looks like while you folks are coming up with your final questions here, I've very consciously been playing the skeptic tonight with regard to social media, and I have seen the conversation that's been going on behind us. I've been doing that purposely because I wanted to make sure that we had, you know, a pretty in-depth conversation about the risks, and I think that that we have acknowledged that there are risks and that there are also clearly great benefits. So I would love to change the tone for just a moment here and get your best sales pitch to those in the audience who maybe have not dipped their toe in yet, or, you know, sell me on Facebook. Why should I do it?
Me?
Sure.
Can I sell you on Twitter?
Go for it.
Okay.
Sell me on Twitter. So why would you choose Twitter instead of Facebook as the thing to sell me on?
I choose Twitter to sell you on because I think that you can find value there in topics of your own interest. So for me personally, the way that I normally sell it is to talk about my personal experience. And for me personally, I have found a great resource in doing what I do on Twitter. So I've found contacts with other professors who teach public relations and strategic communication across the nation who are sharing resources that are valuable to me, that have improved my teaching in the classroom, and that have benefited the lives of my students. And I think that that is extremely valuable. So for those resources and for those connections that I've made, I would encourage Twitter use.
Denny?
Well, I think that really, 550 million people are on Facebook, Julie, so you should be there. No.
Everybody's doing it.
So just, yeah, okay.
I mean, we're pack animals, we're tribal, that's our mentality. So, you know, we kind of flock to things where people, we have opportunities to be social and to connect. But it's to jump into a social network just for the sake of the fact that everyone else is doing it is not the best decision. I really think that, you know, you need to be intentional, like I said earlier, and find out why do you want to participate. So for some folks, it's, you know, catching up with their graduating class from high school, or being able to be stalked by your old flames. but
or
I really
stalk
think,
them, right?
Right, or stalk them secretly. I think that, you know, what I've noticed in my personal life, to kind of speak to that for a moment, is that to make those connections, for whether it's they're of a personal nature or a professional nature, it's just been incredibly valuable to have part of that be visible to other people, because I can connect folks to one another who I think might have things in common or might benefit from a mutual, you know, relationship. And I don't know, it's definitely just the way that our world is heading, to be social and to be engaged on the web.
Earlier you talked about how it had enabled you to make a circle of friends and sort of integrate into a new community when
right.
you moved to Charlotte. So.
And I think with the way that the internet is evolving, and this is more geek speak, but you're inputting information into the web, and that is actually making your experience there more relevant. So that part of that targeting, yes, is a little bit big brother, and it can be intimidating and scary, but it's also helping you to find the information you're looking for more quickly. It's making that information more contextual, more relevant. So, you know, those are big reasons to be engaged in the social web, in my mind.
Yeah. So, Jonathan, I'm curious. You do a moderate amount of social media, like you said earlier. If you were to counsel someone, a good friend, or to maybe who was trying to figure out if they should get involved in social media, knowing what you know about the legal ramifications?
Yeah. The examples I gave you all of people who got in trouble with their employers, they're really dumb things they were doing. I mean, anyone who exercises a moderate degree of common sense is not going to run into these problems. Your employers aren't sitting there monitoring every move you make on social networks. They have better things to do with their time. And I have lots of clients who are using these social networks for really wonderful and productive things. I can tell you about sales organizations. I mean, old industry, heavy manufacturing folks whose salespeople have adopted this and are tweeting the special of the day on steel or on widgets or whatever, and are making a tremendous inroads into their customers with this. So the benefits greatly outweigh the downside. You just need to exercise some common sense.
Show of hands, anybody here who's been converted tonight and they're going to go home and try something they haven't tried on social media? Still a little hesitant there. All right, a question from the audience. What community resources are available for social media outreach for nonprofits and small businesses? Community resources.
SocialMediaCharlotte.com.
Yeah, I can put in a
go for it
plug here for Social Media Charlotte. Is a local networking organization, and we hold a monthly breakfast. And actually, this year we're looking at kind of diversifying, creating some other events for folks. I know that not everyone can make it during that 7:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. time frame. But presently, we don't have a cost for a membership. You just pay per event that you attend. And we bring in, you know, local thought leaders, people that are making some waves in the social media space here in the community. John actually was on one of our panels recently. And that would be a great resource for anyone who's looking to continue to engage and build connections in the community.
What would you recommend, Jonathan, if people are looking to sort of better understand what their legal concerns might be?
Well, there are plenty of websites out there that will help you with this. There are lots of free articles that are posted. Findlaw.com is a good resource for folks to look at, and there are other websites as well that keep an eye on the developing issues in this as well and can be a good resource.
John, I'm curious to know if people wanted to find a model, someone to model, you know, to kind of start to follow, to get a sense of who's doing it really well out there, either professionally or personally, on the social media side, who would you recommend they watch?
Danny Burns, of course. Oh.
All right.
Great.
People are using it for different purposes. So it depends on what your purpose is. It depends on what the mission of your Twitter platform is. But I think to look at some people that are doing it really well, not doing it really well, but who have a lot of information to share. If you're new to Twitter, check out Mashable, who's not the most deep thinker on social media, but can share with you a lot of information and links, and you'll find some information there. I think if you're looking for people locally, a great thing to do would be to Social Media Charlotte. Their board is doing fantastic work in this area, and you could check out what they're doing. In addition, you know, at Queen's University of Charlotte, I'll give a plug, we have a master's program in strategic communication, and we're taking on this issue of digital communication, so you could look to some information and resources that are provided there.
And in terms of Social Media Charlotte, too, I should probably mention Scott Hepburn is our current president, and Nathan Ritchie here in the audience is our past president. Both of those guys are just incredibly genuine, helpful, would love to connect with you, I know, and will probably throttle me later for calling them out in the middle of the audience, but I would definitely suggest following them and reaching out. Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to wrap it up for us tonight. We'd like to thank everybody who was involved in our very active Twitter feed here tonight, and please keep the conversation going. Hashtag WFAE PubCon. It'll continue to be there, and we'd love to see this conversation continue. You can also see John and Danny are on Twitter, and they have websites. Is there any social media contact you want to mention there, Jonathan?
Profiles on LinkedIn and our old-fashioned website, parkerpoe.com.
All right. And thanks to all of you for being here tonight and sharing your insights as well. Hopefully you found this enlightening. We're grateful for your participation. And stay tuned for the next public conversation with WFAE in a couple of months.